Hello, everyone, and welcome to the TMA Ask the Expert podcast series. Today's podcast is entitled Navigating Life After a Rare Neuroimmune Disorder, Social Security, Benefits, Assistive Technology, and More. My name is Gigi DeFebri, and I will be moderating this podcast. The TMA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at myelitis.org. This podcast is being recorded and will be made available on the TMA website for download via iTunes. During the call, if you have any additional questions, you can send a message through the chat option available with GoToWebinar. For today's podcast, we are pleased to be joined by Sandy Hannebrink and Catherine Treadaway. Sandy is the executive director of Touch the Future, Inc. Sandy was diagnosed with transverse myelitis in 1985. She is a Paralympian with gold, silver, and bronze medals. She's set many national and international records over her career and still holds American records for shot put, discus, javelin, and in swimming. Sandy is an occupational therapist who has developed a practice niche in advocacy, assistive technology, and networking individuals with disabilities and service providers to the necessary resources and funding to achieve individual life goals. She has multiple presentations and publications at the local to international level, including topics on effectively educating and employing individuals with disabilities, reasonable accommodations, disability laws, disabled sports, and assistive technology. Sandy has received many awards and recognitions for her work. Catherine received her bachelor's degree in sociology and master of social work at Louisiana State University. She started her career at the Baton Rouge General Medical Center on their general medicine floor, gaining social work experience on all the units there, including telemetry, burn oncology, OBGYN, and the ER. She received her board certifications in 1998 from the Louisiana State Board of Board Certified Social Work Examiners. When Catherine first moved to Dallas, she worked as a case manager at Presbyterian Hospital of Dallas on their physical rehabilitation unit for orthopedic and neurologic patients. Catherine has been at the Multiple Sclerosis Program at UT Southwestern since September of 2002. She works with the dynamic multidisciplinary team in the MS clinic and the pediatric demyelinating disease clinic, participating in research and patient care. She assists patients by serving as their advocate, locating resources, providing counseling, support and information, and arranging home and outpatient care. She also assisted in the development of the Total Life Care Clinic, a clinic within the MS clinic, as well as participates in this weekly multidisciplinary clinic for at-risk patients. Welcome and thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, we're happy to be here.
Yeah.
So to start, we're gonna start really broadly. The first question is, what benefits are available to people with rare neuroimmune disorders? Sandy, if you don't mind starting us off.
Sure. I guess a lot of it depends on how old you are at the time, what benefits may apply. But just to kind of put a list out there, if you will, number one benefit people start with usually is with Social Security, with either supplemental security income, disability benefits, or Social Security disability income, SSDI benefits. Also with Social Security, you have ticket to work programs. There's Medicaid waiver programs. For school-aged individuals, you have IDEA, Individuals Education Act, 504, and the ADA could apply. Vocational rehabilitation services, community long-term care support services, social service programs for needs-based support with housing, food stamps. There's assistive technology device loans, as well as financial loan programs. There's private support from different scholarships, grants, and foundations. One in particular that's been very helpful to many in our community in disabled sports would be the Challenge Athletes Fund. There's short-term disability benefits, there's long-term disability benefits, there's Family Medical Leave Act, there's crowdfunding opportunities, there's Centers for Independent Living, and then my organization is a Touch the Future is a nonprofit organization, and we've actually set up a special discount for members of TMA as a partnership for TMA.
Great, thank you. That was definitely a comprehensive overview. Catherine, do you have any other benefits?
There was. I think Sandy kind of pretty much covered all that's out there, I think.
And we'll go into more detail about each. Sorry, go ahead, Catherine.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was just going to say for the Medicaid waiver programs, I was looking into this because, you know, it's different for every state what they offer. And I found this site called MedicaidWaiver.org. And that will give you a listing for each state of what's available. So like the waiver programs in Texas are going to be different from the waiver programs in Louisiana. But it shows you how to apply for those programs. And some of those programs may not be based, they may be based on the child's income rather than the family's income, like it is for SSI.
And would you mind just explaining what a Medicaid waiver is?
So like here in Texas, like one of our Medicaid waiver programs is the Medically Dependent Children's Program, or MDCP. And through that program, parents can get hours for caregiving assistance for their child. And depending on the medical needs of the child, you know, they may get so many hours a week. They could get nursing hours through that program as well. So it's based on their medical need. And that program's not based on the child's income, based really just on their need for nursing care. And then once you get one of these Medicaid waiver programs, you will get Medicaid with that program. So of course, with like health insurance, we have the CHIPS Medicaid program and also just traditional Medicaid. But yeah, so that's some of the programs that are available. And then as people get older, they get on waiting lists for some of these waiver programs to help them live in the community as independently as possible. But again, they're different for every state. So your state might offer something that we don't offer.
Right.
And it's important. You can find out on that website.
Yeah, okay. It's important to understand what is available within each state because, like you said, some states have very strong waiver programs for children and not as many opportunities for adults. There are some opportunities with the head and spinal cord injury waivers tend to be there. And the way Medicaid waivers work is you have defined Medicaid benefits within your state, whether you qualify as a child Medicaid program, through a traditional Medicaid or some of the disability or senior Medicaid programs that different states have. But then the waiver pays for things that Medicaid may not typically pay for, but they will pay for through the waiver program. So they pay above what traditional Medicaid would pay. And Medicaid a lot of times is a gatekeeper for other benefits and services. So that's where people look at things there. Also, one of the benefits I didn't speak to is the money follows the person under the Olmstead Act, so that it helps people to be able to stay in the community and in their home and not have to go into institutionalized care or nursing homes.
Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And there are waiver programs for adults as well. But they are income based, but you can get things like equipment and additional therapies through the Medicaid waiver programs as well.
Okay. Okay. Thank you both for that thorough explanation. So moving on to, you know, we talked about all these benefits kind of broadly. Where can someone find benefits that they may be eligible for or, know where to go to look to see if they're eligible for these things. Sandy?
Well, by law, every state has an office or within the state for the Office of Disability and Senior Issues. Sometimes they're separate, sometimes they're not, sometimes they're called other things. In South Carolina, it's housed under the Lieutenant Governor's Office on Aging and Disability. So that would be one place to start is you can actually call your governor's office and ask for the ombudsman. to direct you to the services for individuals with disabilities. Another way to get connected to disability resources without having to be the one doing all the searches is through your Centers for Independent Living that are in each state and many times multiple facilities across each state. You can also look on the National Council for Independent Living's website, which will connect you to many resources just through the online search. But a lot of the information you can find as far as government programs are in old school, go to the blue pages of the phone book. And the services are listed there as well.
Okay, and Catherine, I know that you're a social worker at UT Southwestern. Do a lot of hospitals have social workers that may be able to direct people to different benefits?
I would think so, yes. So, my role is at UT Southwestern as well as at Children's. And here at Children's, the social work department has made handouts for almost all resources you could possibly think of nationally and in this area. So maybe getting connected with the social work department at the hospital that you go to, I'm sure they would have some resources for you. And in a lot of states, you can call 211,
yeah.
And it's an information site, and it can direct you as far as applying for, MDCP or for DADS programs, which is like community attendance service hours, just kind of some of the things we were talking about, like community-based alternative programs. If you just call 211, they'll kind of direct you where you need to go as far as applying for these programs and tell you what programs are available in your area. They'll know about local resources too.
Okay. And then I don't know if either of you have experience with using this, but I've heard also about benefits.gov. Is that an option that you know about or something you have some experience with?
Benefits.gov is going to direct you to benefit, anything related to federal benefits, and then also link to the different states. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is just, how do I find stuff if I don't have a resource? And over the years, my resource bank has grown. It's crazy, right? So, and then trying to remember who did that or who did this or, but just keeping a log of things that you've done and, screenshots of websites or links and things so that you don't lose them. Because I know a lot of people say, well, I was searching for it. Now I can't find it. So just kind of keeping that direct, your favorites and stuff as you search. But a lot of how I find stuff is, I say, what is your diagnosis and what is your need? And I just do a Google search, and you'll be amazed at how many things will pop up. Some that has nothing to do with what you're looking for, but also many others. But if you look at some of the parent support organizations and disability support organizations in the community, in your local community, even if they don't list that they provide services for, say, an adult with transverse myelitis, they will still direct you to the resources because that's what they do. So, I would just say find one organization and ask and then just keep going. Depending on your area, there's going to be more resources. Like at UT Southwestern, in Dallas, there's a lot of opportunities and resources with multiple major medical centers. There, if you can get connected with a major medical center, then the social work departments tend to be more robust versus in like my area where we have rural communities, the social workers call me because they just don't have the same opportunities as a major medical center. So that's just some kind of from personal perspective of how I've been able to build my resource list and be able to assist others.
Thank you. And so we've gotten a few questions about Social Security related benefits. So I'm going to kind of switch gears to talking about that for now. So just as a general overview, Sandy, do you mind giving an overview about what SSI is and what SSDI is and kind of how they differ?
Sure. So SSI, Supplemental Security Income, is a needs-based benefit. So individuals who are not currently insured for Social Security disability benefits. Sometimes, especially with transverse myelitis and other rare neuromuscular, you know, you as a child, you become disabled, so you haven't had the opportunity to work. So, you may become eligible for benefits that way. And then also as a child, if you were disabled before the age of 22, as your parents become eligible for Social Security benefits, whether it's retirement or otherwise, you could become eligible for benefits on your parents' record, but not until they are receiving. That's one confusion people have. But the main difference between SSI and SSDI is SSI is needs-based. You do not have to be insured and have worked and earned so many quarters in order to be eligible. And SSDI is for individuals who have worked and paid their FICA tax, that big chunk of money that comes out of your check every week. That is to pay the premium for Medicare and SSDI or Social Security retirement benefits. So that's kind of how those works. Some people will temporarily get SSI during the waiting period for when Social Security disability kicks in. There is technically it's a 5-month waiting period, but then it's the 6-month that you become eligible. So it's really 6 months before you would receive a cash benefit on Social Security disability. During that 6 months, some individuals may qualify if their income and resources level is in range to receive SSI temporarily. Once you get SSI, in most states, that also entitles you to Medicaid. As long as you get $1 of SSI, then you remain eligible for Medicaid. There are also some differences with Social Security disability and SSI in that how much you can earn after you're receiving those cash benefits and how that's calculated, which would be another whole podcast. But on ssa.gov, you can find the brochures and the publications that explain each of the benefits and how much you can earn, and then how Ticket to Work could applies with SSI and SSDI, and then the benefits of Ticket to Work, where it kind of protects you and gives you an easy back on if your attempts to return to work are not successful.
Got it.
Clear as mud, right? So
yeah, right. It's it's pretty complex as far as between the two, but you covered that really well. I would just add that if you are eligible for Social Security disability, then you will get Medicare medical insurance in 2 years from the date of when you were determined disabled, which is a really big deal to have that medical insurance. And then as Sandy said, with SSI, you usually would get Medicaid insurance with that. But Social Security, they'd use the same disability determination process for both, but the benefits are different. But they're looking at, is it a severe disability, caused by disease or injury that's severe enough to prevent someone from working any kind of job?
So
and
they're
must be expected to last 12 months or more as well. But it's to be a cash income to replace income that you can't get any longer if you're not able to work. But I would encourage you, if you are able to work, it can be really good for your health and happiness to keep working and continuing to challenge you. And I think you already said it takes about 3 to 5 months to find out if you're approved or not, but it could take years if you have to go through the appeal process. And this is kind of something that might be of interest, is that now Social Security, this just happened last year, but they now consider the notes and opinions of physician assistants and nurse practitioners. So they are now considered acceptable medical sources. I know we have a lot of MPs and PAs in our practice, and they're seeing patients, and it's becoming really important as far as your Social Security review, if you are applying, that you have office notes that are talking about you know, the symptoms that you're having, what difficulties you're having, because that is the main thing they're going to be looking at, is these, you know, reputable medical sources for these office notes. And I think in the past, people would write letters and things like that, but they're kind of saying that they are not giving special weight to that anymore, like statements from the medical sources. They really just want the information. So if you are thinking about applying or you're applying, it's really important to have recent notes and discussion about what's going on.
Yeah. So Social Security, as part of that decision process, does looks at different things. So they look at, you know, when was the onset date of the symptoms, and to the point that they were severe enough that you could not work. And it either interrupted work, or if you were at an age where you weren't quite ready to work, how is it impacting you? You know, how could it impact you in the future? They're looking at whether or not there's a job readily available in the national economy that you can do based on what your capacity is as a person to be able to work, but also looking at what your past work experience has been. So you'll see some people who, if they've been, you know, they were a construction worker and they've always done heavy lifting kind of jobs, and now they're in their 50s and they ended up with transverse myelitis, and now you know, they have different varying levels of paralysis, but maybe you're able to ambulate. That individual who's always had a heavy lifting type job may get approved for disability, when somebody who was a manager and did everything with a computer and worked from home may not. So it's all case by case is how they're looking at it. So you can't really compare yourself to someone else. And I think that's what gets people frustrated a lot of times too. The other thing is if there's a lot of people get denied for benefits early with Social Security because they're first diagnosed. The physicians can't even document what they think your prognosis is going to be yet, because you haven't even been diagnosed for 3 months and they haven't even seen what kind of return and rehabilitation you might have, and you'll get what's called a durational denial. And people get frustrated and said, I was denied, and throw their hands up like, you know, they can't. So you really have to look at, what does the denial letter say? You may have been denied because you're not insured for benefits for SSDI, and then you were denied on SSI because you have too much money in the bank, or your income coming in is too much, or you own two cars, because with SSI, a house and a car are exempt, but that second car counts as a resource. And so if it's valued at over $2,000, you're denied because you have resources, because again, SSI is a needs-based program. SSDI doesn't care what you own. It's all about being insured for disability insurance to replace your income that you can no longer have because you became disabled and can't work. So it's important to understand the dynamics of things. But like Catherine said, your medical record is what's key. What the doctors have said your condition is and all your conditions. So just like anything, I have transverse myelitis, but I also have all kinds of other autoimmune issues. And I've had, before I became disabled with TM, I had sports injuries and stuff. So then I had some arthritis or whatever. Well, we listed everything because they're looking at your entire, the entire you, not just a single diagnosis. And I think a lot of people forget to add issues like neuropathic pain. They forget to add depression. They forget to add
severe fatigue.
Fine motor deficits, bowel and bladder function deficits, you know, and things like that. But just giving a diagnosis, a single diagnosis, isn't enough. But most important, what's critical, is having your doctors document what's there. And the more medical records you can provide up front that support your cause, because if they have enough information to make a determination based on what you've already provided, they don't have to go dig in from everywhere else where you might have had somebody that didn't know what the heck you had and they caused a conflicting record. And so then it leaves it to question and you get denied because some doctor thought you had something else and it wasn't permanent, because then there's a record there. So it's really critical to provide as much good medical evidence on the front end, but not too soon. I know it's terrible and you're without income and whatever, but applying too soon can actually make things take so much longer. But we always tell people, you know, depending on the severity of what's going on and the fact that within TM world, you know, in our world now, we know more about prognosis earlier. 3 months would be the earliest I would look at applying, and that's if you have good medical documentation.
Yeah, and I was just looking, I had this, had written this down, that I guess under age 44 is they're looking at that, can this person do any kind of work? So like you were saying, as far as your age, you know, as you get older, they're going to be looking more at like, well, can you do the job you've been doing or not? Or would you be able to, you know, learn a new skill set? But with SSDI, people can work a little bit. It just cannot be considered substantial gainful activity, SGA. So I think it's around 1180-ish that people are able to make.
Yeah, but the first $85 is exempt, and then 1180 is the dollar amount for people just with physical disabilities. But if people also have neuromyelitis optica, and that where they have vision, where they're considered legally blind, then that dollar amount goes up.
Yeah. And this is not unusual to happen, that the Social Security may ask you to go for a consultative exam to get some more evidence. But that's why it's even more important to go to your current doctor who knows you and can document as much as possible. Like even our clinic, if someone's thinking about applying for disability, we'll have them come in with our NP and do, you know, kind of like a disability visit, you know, to discuss, you know, what are the issues, what kind of symptoms, just so there's a recent note in there. Because if there's nothing recent and you decide to apply, well, they're probably not going to have the good information they need. And then they send you for this consult that might last 15 minutes and isn't going to really get a comprehensive view of what's going on with you day to day.
Right, right. Thank you. I know it's very complicated and you both did a really good job explaining such a, you know, it's a daunting task to apply. And then, you know, when people get denied, it can be, you know, really disheartening. So,
The biggest thing though is look at those dates. You only have 15 days, which includes the mailing times. So you must appeal within those time frames or you lose that window of opportunity to appeal. If it's a income and resources denial and now your income and resources have dropped, because you're having to use everything you have to cover things, that happens. So, appeal it. If you're, if it's a medical denial, submit the appeal and schedule an appointment with your physician so that you can document what's going on. Like Catherine said, it's critical.
It really is. And some people may have long or short-term employment disability benefits. And sometimes those companies will work in tandem, like the benefits work. The employer benefits want you to get on Social Security disability so that they pay less of the their benefits that they're giving. So sometimes they have attorneys even on staff with these employment disability policies that can help you when you're applying for Social Security disability. But again, Social Security, it's like a supplement. It's not going to be what your income was. It's going to be just a portion of your income.
Right. Okay. We have two kind of specific questions about Social Security. The first one is, we were told by someone that our income is too high for our son to get Social Security benefits. We live in a very high cost of living area and have four children, so our income does not go far, especially in light of our son's medical needs. Others have told us that our son qualifies based on his medical condition alone, regardless of income, which is true. Either of you want to answer this one?
One, they're talking about SSI, not SSDI.
Okay,
so SSI again is needs-based. So that would take into account household income. They do, depending on how old he is, if he's a working age, they do also consider subsidies where, I work for this employer and he helped me out. I really wasn't doing the same job I was doing, but he paid me the same. They're not going to penalize, the government doesn't penalize that employer for being nice people, being a good company for supporting their employees. But the value of my work compared to similarly situated other employees is less because they're subsidizing me. So that portion of the subsidy would come off the top of what those expenses are. The other thing that's considered is employment related work expenses. So like I have an accessible van with a lift, then a certain amount of mileage can come off the top. My copay on assistive technologies or medications and catheters and supplies and things like that that I have to have in order to be able to work are considered employment related work expenses. So that comes off the top. So it is very likely that someone who is does have a disability and is working may be able to work and still receive benefits. But you have to be able to document that. Individuals who are blind have additional things that can be written off as far as employment-related work expenses. The cost of reasonable accommodations that an employer provides is also considered a subsidy. So those are the kind of things that can help someone who's working be eligible. In the case of a child of parents who are working and they have, exceed the income and resources, unfortunately, they won't be eligible for SSI. Now, they may be eligible for the child Medicaid benefits. So it won't be a cash benefit, but it will also give them Medicaid. And again, Medicaid is the gatekeeper for many other state, and which are also federally supported, but state-funded programs for attendant care, for assistive technology, for Medicaid waiver supports and that. So it could still help the family with how much out of pocket they're having to pay for things because that child has benefits. But as far as a cash benefit, directly, they wouldn't be eligible, but indirectly, they would get financial support by having that child Medicaid benefit, which then opens the door for other social service programs.
And thank you. Kathleen, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's correct. I mean, it is a complex kind of formula that they look at and make certain allowances and things. But my understanding is, as far as resources, it's a $2,000 max limit for a family.
$3,000 for a household, $2,000 for an individual.
For an individual. Of course, you can have your house, like you said, one car and your house. But once that child turns 18, they're going to be looking at just the child's income and resources. So at that time, that child might be eligible for SSI.
Right.
And again, you're talking about the Medicaid waiver programs. You know, that child might be eligible from a medical standpoint to get a Medicaid waiver program, which again will open up into some other resources that you might not have had otherwise.
Yeah. And the other thing that SSI is, again, it's needs-based. So SSI also considers what your living arrangement is. So if you are 18 and older and they have what they call an A living arrangement and a B living arrangement. In an A living arrangement, you're independent and you're responsible for all your own expenses. In a B living arrangement, you may still live at home with your family, and they're going to look at how many people are in that household, and say there's five people in the house, what's the mortgage, what's the utilities, what's insurance, food, you know, et cetera. What's that total divided by five, and can your SSI benefit cover your equal share? Then you would be in a living arrangement. If not, and your family is basically supporting you also, you would get what's considered a B living arrangement, and then the dollar amount would be less.
Okay. And then do you happen to know, Sandy, I'm not 100% sure, you probably know the answer to this question, but what category Social Security lists impairment under the Blue Book?
For transverse myelitis?
I'm guessing, yeah.
The categories are going to be based on, again, it's not just on a single diagnosis. They're going to look at each category for every diagnosis you have. So transverse myelitis, you might be under neurologic. You might be under bowel and bladder function. You might be under depression. You might be under chronic pain. So they're looking at all of your conditions and stuff within the Blue Book, but your primary diagnosis of transverse myelitis is going to be under neurologic.
Correct. I don't think there's not a listing per se like there is for some conditions. Like MS, multiple sclerosis, they have a listing, and then you have to meet all these certain, you know, requirements.
Yeah.
I don't know that, like you say, there's not a listing for TM, so they're looking at all the symptoms, you know, and how is that impacting your ability to work?
Yeah, they do kind of, depending on which disability determination office, they do use MS as kind of a guide as well. But they, you know, they look at similarly situated because that's the best information they have, because there's not enough people with transverse myelitis with the same symptoms that it gives it a unique listing.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay. So moving on from, you know, Social Security, which again is a very complicated topic. We could do like a 5-hour long podcast only on Social Security. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, in terms of the pediatric side. Kathryn, if you wouldn't mind just giving a little bit of information on IEPs and 504s and what that is for kids.
Yeah, so I think this is just, you know, kind of a relief, hopefully, for parents that there are support services for children from kindergarten all the way through college. And there is a Section 504. It's a civil rights law, and it was created to protect individuals with disabilities from discrimination or being excluded from programs and activities. that are federally funded. And so we may set up a 504 for our kids when they need some kind of accommodation, be it like they might need extra time to complete assignments, ability to leave class earlier to get to their next class, have a short break, be able to go use the bathroom when they need to, you know, water as often as needed, just things like that. So that can just be given to the school from the physician. They just need a diagnosis. So just to be sure that the kids are getting whatever they need so they can be successful. And then there's also the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, and under this program, people get an individualized education plan. So you might have heard of ARDS and things like that. These are meetings to come together with the teachers, with the therapists, with the parents, to come into a just come up with whatever the child's unique learning needs are, and putting together a plan for teachers to follow. And it also, you know, provides modifications, accommodations in the child's classroom. And this is up to from birth to 21 years of age. And there's this one website that kind of explains the difference between 504s and IEPs. And it's called understood.org. And I think it kind of focuses on like ADHD, ADD, but I mean, there is so much good information on this website because it talks about 504s and gives all kinds of parenting tips and tips for kids and, you know, kids who don't want to go to school and things like that. So that's just a really good website that you could go to get information. But just back to the IEP, like things, again, modifications, accommodations, you know, it just allows whatever's necessary for the child to be able to do their classwork and participate.
Okay, thank you. And to everyone listening,
you can add to that.
Yeah.
And you can get with your IEP, they may write in that you're getting therapy services like physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy, and they're all part of the planning.
Okay, thank you. We've gotten a few questions about employment and issues related to employment. So one question is there anything in the ADA to accommodate transverse myelitis in employment evaluations? And can one be docked because of absences when an FMLA leave was approved by the employer? Sandy, do you mind taking this one?
Sure. So an individual disability with transverse myelitis would be covered under the ADA. Many employers, unfortunately, are still trying to use old definition, the original ADA definition and not the 2010 definition of the ADA. Employment evaluations, if you go on ada.gov, which is the Department of Justice website, it gives clear Q&A document on when and how employment evaluations can be used. And employment evaluations can be used if they're used across the board for everyone and not used to single out disability and either reject employment or terminate employment. The question with FMLA, if you are on leave for leave that you have, you know, you're using your vacation time, you're using your sick time, whatever those policies are, those are approved excused absence time. You know, that's a benefit that you have. If you have approved FMLA, they cannot terminate you based on absences within, you know, that during the term that you are under FMLA. You're protected because of that. And that's why FMLA exists, because of people who had chronic conditions or, you know, have family member to care for, et cetera. So it would even protect family members who are caring for someone that has developed a rare neuromuscular disorder. The ADA, you know, with specifically speaking to Title I for employment, provides many protections from pre-employment to post-employment in retirement. So you can't, any benefit that's provided to the whole cannot be denied based on disability. So there are protections there. And then in addition, if the business or organization is a recipient of any federal dollars, not for the job that you're in, but just any federal dollars, you know, what, like a university who gets grant money or participates in the student loan programs and Pell grants and things like that, or a business that's a federal contractor, then the Rehabilitation Act would also apply. So you have additional protections. But with regard to transverse myelitis and that, the biggest thing that people need to know is you have to look at your employee handbook and understand what the process is. And then if they don't have a process listed, that's a violation in itself, but it's to document, and the employer is not obligated to provide reasonable accommodations just because they know you have transverse myelitis. You have to disclose and request a reasonable accommodation, and that is wholly your responsibility, because it's illegal for an employer to ask what your disability is, and it's, you know, and to make an assumption that you have a need. So it's really important for you to know your rights, to know what your disability is, to know what accommodations you need to do that. If you're not sure, then organizations like Vocational Rehabilitation, your Centers for Independent Living, and there's 10 ADA centers across the country, as well as you can call the U.S. Access Board, that provide free technical support to help answer those questions related to your employment. The Job Accommodation Network, JAN, is another resource. And then the Office of Disability and Policy at the Department of Labor is another. Does that help?
Yes, yes, thank you. And we got another question, Catherine, I don't know if you mind taking this one. This person says, my son had ADEM and optic neuritis as a child, and is now 26. Entering the workforce has been extremely difficult, even after attending technical school. Working with vocational rehab in our state has not been successful. Can you speak about anything we can do to help him be successful and remain employed? He has executive functioning and some processing issues. We have not broached the subject of his challenges with his current employer of 6 months.
Hey, well, just to kind of go back to what Sandy was saying, you know, the Job Accommodation Network is just a really fabulous resource, and they can help him to kind of figure out what accommodations he needs to be able to continue to work, just to help even just draft a letter for his physician, or help his physician to write that letter of what, kind of what the things that he needs. I mean, normally, if like here, I would be referring them to Texas Workforce Solutions, which is our vocational rehab program. And, you know, I would say if for whatever reason that office, we have so many offices in our area, you know, maybe just trying a different office to get a different set of eyes on his case, just to see maybe another counselor would have some other ideas on how to help him. If they haven't had any luck with the current person. And going back just real quick to the FMLA thing, I just want to say, you know, I have not heard of people being docked, but the employer does not have to pay you for the time that you're taking off. It's, again, just to protect your job if you have to take time off. But if you are concerned about something that's happening like that, you can always call the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and kind of just go over your case and say, this is what's happening. Is this, you know, legal? Is this, you know, how is this okay? What's happening, you know, and just kind of guide you into what you should do next. You know, and maybe that would help help this person too. Yeah.
And the EEOC is really good at providing technical advice. You can call them without it meaning that you filed a claim. So they'll answer your questions and give you the specifics of how the law is, and then they can explain what the process is if you're choosing to file a claim. But there are timelines for employment discrimination. So as far as statute of limitation kind of things that you have to file within certain time frames. The other resource on this employment though is go to the Social Security SSA.gov and look at Ticket to Work. There are Ticket to Work program managers that are vocational support organizations that are contracted to work with people to utilize their Ticket to Work opportunity. And there's a couple different ways you can search to find ways to help you achieve your work goals. And so there's also free job support for individuals 18 to 64 on their website. So go to the SSA.gov and go to Ticket to Work, and you can do a guided search that helps determine your readiness for the program and provides a list of service providers, or you can do a direct search just to list service providers serving your zip code.
Okay, thank you. And then we did actually get a few separate questions about making a home kind of accommodation. So one of them is there any assistance, financial or volunteer labor programs to get housing adapted to wheelchair accessibility? I was only working part-time intermittently prior to TM striking, so I do not think I'm eligible for any Social Security assistance. It's exhausting trying to maneuver through my days without access to most of my home. Can the expense of the bathroom, kitchen remodel, or any part of the house be deducted, or is there any assistance that you can get for doing that? Sandy?
Yeah, in my area, pretty much cross country, there's a lot of organizations that's usually falls under the umbrella of either the Medicaid waiver programs who provide support for that. If this individual has no income and means of support, they more than likely would be eligible for Medicaid, depending on what their income and resources are. The other would be your private private charities and foundations. And I live in the South, so faith-based organizations are huge with this. People who do ramps and rails programs, small home modifications and that. And in the area where I live, there's an organization called Rebuild Upstate. Habitat for Humanity is actually included accessible housing options and things in their programs nationwide as well, and helping the people be able to age in place. United Way could have links to resources in your local communities for organizations who have funding under their basic needs or healthcare needs type programs. So there are things there. Another site you could look on is the Pass It On Center, which is a website where you can go look at all the different, many of the assistive technology act programs in the different states, in the reutilization programs where people are refurbishing equipment and providing access to resources for ramps, computers, et cetera. So that's one site, your state ATAC programs. There are also loan programs through the ATAC. One of the loan programs is specifically for assistive technology and home modifications, accessible vehicles, and things like that. It allows for longer term and lower interest type loans for people, for things that typically people couldn't get loans for. Those are administered differently in each state, your ATAC program for your state, your Assist Technology Act program for each state should be able to provide that resource, or you can find that on the Pass It On Center as well, or at the National Assist Technology Program website. The other loan program they have is specifically designed for getting technology for employment. So it is for financial loan support for getting technologies you need to be able to work. A lot of people can't work because they can't afford to get the technology they need to work. And it is much easier to get employed if you can provide your own accommodations, especially if it's a cost type of accommodation of needing a specialized computer access device or something. Yes, an employer legally is required to provide it, but we all know if you already have it, you can show that you can do the job, you'll be more successful. Then there are also some loan programs that for equipment that you can get either ramps or handrails or things like that, drop hinges, bathtub inserts and things like that. So is there. And then the other source is, of course, crowdfunding. But I caution people with crowdfunding because crowdfunding is considered income. So if that crowdfunding campaign is in your name or your family's name, that income could knock you out of eligibility for Medicaid and SSI in the month that you receive it until it's spent down. And it is taxable, unearned income, taxable income. So, you know, a lot of people don't realize that that crowdfunding income is taxable and that it counts against your income and resources for eligibility for services. So just be careful with how you set those up and whose name that they're in. Even if it's in someone else's name and it's going to benefit you, if any of that cash comes in the form of a gift, it could count against your eligibility for benefits. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, thank you. And then just also just from my personal experience, you know, I rent my apartment and I requested that the landlords make accommodations in my bathroom, for example, and like my door handles and stuff. And they did that because they're legally obligated to under, you know, if it's not an unreasonable request or over a certain amount of money. So that's if you rent, that might be an option as well.
Under it depends on that. If they under Fair Housing Act, there's certain obligations, and then ADA, but a landlord is required to allow you to make a modification, but they can at your own expense, and then they can require you to put it back to its original state when you leave, unless they are a recipient of federal dollars or part of like some of the HUD programs, and then they have an obligation. And then they also there's an obligation for a certain number under Fair Housing Act of the units to be accessible now under new construction and then even alterations that are done for if there's more than four units on a facility. You know, there's all kinds of rules that apply to Fair Housing Act. But Fair Housing HUD is actually doing advertising now across the country to inform people of their rights if they're being discriminated against access to accessible housing and affordable housing based on disability.
Got it.
And I just say most states are going to have, just like you're saying, local services. Like in Texas, we have the Texas Ramp Project. You can be referred to get a ramp. But I just want to throw this resource out that I've come across and had suggested some people apply for. It's rebuildingtogether.org, and they have locations all over the U.S. I mean, they're in several states, and they go in and try to repair houses, you know, for whatever they need, you know, if you own a home. So that might be something that you qualify for as well. rebuildingtogether.org.
Okay, thank you. Wow, so we are unfortunately at the end of our time. Again, these issues are so complicated and so, you know, there's just a lot of information. You're both incredibly knowledgeable about these different resources and stuff. So thank you so much for your time. I hope we can continue this conversation in a future podcast as well. And for everyone listening, this podcast was recorded and will be made available on our website and via iTunes for download. So thank you both so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. And if people have questions or, looking for technology resources, feel free to contact me through my organization at touchthefuture.us.
Thank you. And yeah, if there's any other questions too, you can feel free to send them to info@myelitis.org and we'll direct them. Yeah. Well, so thank you.